Hey there, I'm Mark Scarborough, and this is the podcast Walking with Dante, a podcast that is walking, now toward the back of Canto 13 of Purgatorio. In this episode of the podcast, we're going to be at lines 94 through 111, and at long last, we are finally going to meet this envious penitent on the terrace of Purgatorio, the second terrace, the terrace after the prideful and after the gate with the tremendous angel. Oh, she's finally going to make an appearance. I know I've been putting her off because the passage has been putting her off. This is my English language translation of the medieval Florentine. You can find it on my website, markscarbo.com or walkingwithdante.com. This is the most delayed gratification I can possibly imagine. Good grief. This is some postmodern structure here. Okay, anyway, you can find it on that website. You can print it off. You can make your own notes. You can continue the conversation with me. You might want to, because this woman is quite fascinating. So, without anything else to say, let's just read Purgatorio, Canto 13, lines 94 through 111. Oh, my brother. Each one of us is a citizen of the one true city, but you wanted to ask which of us lived in Italy as a pilgrim. I seem to hear this reply as if from a spot a bit ahead of where I'd come to a stop, so I made myself felt by them as I moved ahead. Among the others, I saw a shade who looked to be waiting for something. Much as the blind do, it was already raising its chin to hear, as if someone were about to say, "What's up?" I said, "Spirit, you who domesticate yourself in order to go higher up, if you're the one who made that response to me, make yourself known by your hometown and your name." "I was Sienese," she said, "and with these I now mend my wicked life, weeping to the one who can grant himself to us. I wasn't wise, although I was called Sapia. I felt joy at the bad fortune of others more so than I did at my own good fortune." We're going to break it right there, where she just introduces herself, gives her name. We're going to talk about that in a minute. We're going to talk about this whole problem of pilgrimage, which is really important. And then a very wild reflexive verb in the middle of this passage. So let's get to all of these crazy details, as we always do. Starting off at line 94. Remember, Dante has said, "Hey, are there any Italians, Latina?" And we talked about this last time about the grammatical alignment of anima, spirit, and Latina, but it also anticipates a feminine shade, who in fact she is. He sets this up and asks if there's anyone there so that he can learn from them. And she then replies, "Oh, my brother." And notice the fraternal relationship. He asked for an ethnic relationship. He asked for a Latina, a Latin soul, an Italian soul. He asked for someone of his linguistic group. She changed it to familial. And she changed it not as in political alliances or ethnic alliances, but as in kinship alliances. "Oh, my brother. Each of us is a citizen of the one true city." She's schooling him right here. "But you wanted to ask," oh, you didn't know how to ask this question. "You wanted to ask which of us lived in Italy as a pilgrim." I want to talk through this use of the word pilgrim. It's not the first time we've come across it, but it is one of the more important moments in comedy. One, Dante is not in his home in Florence. He himself is a pilgrim by nature, by law, by judgment, by legal action, by being at this point. So when she says, "Hey, what you want to know is which of us lived in Italy as a pilgrim," because life on the terrestrial sphere, which is the same world that Purgatorio is on, but over there in the land of the living, That's the pilgrim spot. There were all pilgrims making our way here. When she says that, not only has she given him a kinship term, brother, she's identified herself with him. Pilgrim. Hey, we're all pilgrims here. And you should also know, and we'll get to this next time when we get more into her story, you should know that this individual endowed a hospital or a hostel. You know, hospital doesn't mean what it means now. A way station, a hostel, a hospital, a resting place, a place to be sick. All those words are wrapped up in hospital. Even a place of spiritual retreat, hospital. It's all bound up together. But anyway, this person endowed a hospital for pilgrims in her own day. So she is directly connected to the concept of pilgrimage. Let's talk about this for just a minute because I think it's really important to unpack pilgrim. I realize that pilgrim is one of these words that's become so tiresome. It's got a tiresome piety behind it. But maybe we can think about this in a couple other ways. Did you know that although the West is secularizing, and in fact, people, for example, in my country, the United States, people who either do not believe in God or doubt the existence of God or belong to no religious organization are now the majority, not the majority, but the greatest number of U.S. citizens. Recent Pew poll said, 28% of U.S. citizens are either atheist, agnostic, or belong to no religious organization. And yet, pilgrimage is more and more of a thing. In fact, the Camino de Santiago in Spain that leads to Compostela, right, the famed pilgrimage route, is more and more crowded. And the people walking that route, most of them at this point, are not doing it for strictly Roman Catholic reasons. Pilgrimage is actually an increasing activity across Western culture without having a formal religious basis on it. That's an interesting bit for us to connect to this passage. But also, let's say the etymology of pilgrim is fascinating to us because if we go back to the etymology of the word pilgrim, what we find is that this word really means to be a foreigner, to be someone who doesn't belong. So a pilgrim is someone who goes to a place that is not where they belong. They're going somewhere to become a stranger, a foreigner, and to experience otherness. I love hiking. I've done it all my life. I grew up in a family that hiked. We know that to walk, to make pilgrimage, is a journey out that is really a journey in. You're walking to get somewhere, but you know where you're getting. You're getting further or farther, or both, further and farther into yourself. And I think that's really important for us to think about here in terms of pilgrimage, because Dante's journey in comedy is indeed a true pilgrimage. It is a journey into his own interiority and into the interiority of others. And it is also a place where he doesn't belong. He's still living. He doesn't belong here. So he truly is a foreigner all across Inferno, Purgatorio, and Paradiso. So being a foreigner, being other, being outside has allowed him profound insights. She seems to acknowledge all of this by saying, A, you and I, we're not just politically related. I'm Sienese, you're Florentine. Yeah, we both speak dialects of Italian. Yeah, we're both from this kind of ethnic group on this peninsula. But hey, guy, we both are learning that the journey out is the journey in. And the journey back there in the land of the living was the journey to get here. And I discovered more and more about myself. And in fact, she will become one of the most honest figures we meet in comedy. She will say things that are shocking, even in this passage. Passing on, next six lines. I seem to hear this reply as if from a spot a bit ahead of where I'd come to a stop. Remember, he was afraid that he was making some kind of offense or transgression by walking by them without saying anything. Virgil's like, just say something. And he gave all that flattery. Well, okay, so she's still a little bit ahead of him. So I made myself felt by them as I moved in. I take this to mean I kicked up some dirt, you know, or I scuffed my feet along the rock so that this person would hear me coming because they're blind. blind because they got their eyelids stitched shut. Among the others, I saw a shade who looked to be waiting for something. Much as the blind do, it was already raising its chin to hear, as if someone were about to say, "What's up?" But what I think is so fascinating here, and we've been playing around this incessantly, is the sheer level of naturalistic detail here. Hearing someone, recognizing the voice comes in front of you, making some kind of noise or racket so that they know that you're coming toward them, and then this gesture, which is typical of blind people, that they lift their heads up to hear. Do they need to lift their heads up? No, they don't. But we know that, in fact, the blind often lift their heads up at sound, in some kind of way, as if they almost could see. And we would have to say that this person can indeed see Dante. She has already schooled him. She's already said you didn't know how to ask the question right. Furthermore, you don't recognize our kinship. And you don't understand that citizenry for us isn't part of political alliance. It's part of the very nature now of our being, because we are citizens of the one true city. Just in that first tercet, she has truly schooled Dante, much more than even Virgil, who in the last passage, you remember, was very curt and said, just speak up and be clear, you know, get on with it, ask them anything. And then Dante gave that florid nine-line flattery for somebody to speak up. And she comes out with three lines that pretty much put him in his place. He then replies to her. I said, "Spirit, you who domesticate yourself in order to go higher up, if you're the one who made that response to me, make yourself known by your hometown and your name." Oh, she may have schooled him, but he still wants to know where she comes from. She may have said, "Listen, buddy, we're all part and citizens of the one true city of God." That's what she means, the New Jerusalem, the city of God. That we're all citizens of that. And he's like, "Yeah, maybe. But where'd you come from? And who are you?" And he's not very teachable. But let's just focus for a moment on a verb here. He says, "Spirit, you who domesticates yourself or controls yourself, or if I wanted to become really wild, dominates yourself or puts yourself in submission in order to go higher up." There's two things here. One, there's a little bit of falconry imagery here. And remember, we had that bit about sewing the eyes of falcons closed. So there's a little bit about that, the wild falcon that has to be tamed. But also, this verb is reflexive. It's not that God is domesticating this spirit. It's that this spirit is domesticating herself. Let's just stop and say, someone else has probably sewn their eyes shut. We don't ever know how their eyelids get threaded with wire, but we assume when they arrive on this terrace that the angel or somebody sews their eyelids shut, and we assume it's highly painful given their weeping. It could be, given this reflexive verb, and I don't think it is, but it could be that they sew their own eyelids shut. I don't buy that. But just the fact that this verb is reflexive, that you domesticate yourself, this is going to become increasingly important over Purgatorio to understand that the action of cleansing is not coming down from on high to you, but that you're willing to cleanse yourself. That is really crucial to understanding Dante's evolving concept of the will. We've already had it throughout Inferno, but it's going to become louder in Purgatorio, that your will has to be made right. If Inferno is about the corruption of the will, as I've told you, then Purgatorio is about the perfection of the will. Part of that involves domesticating yourself. I could push it and say sewing your own eyes shut, but I don't think that's the truth. And yet, there's a little bit of that allowed by the passage. And now she comes back with her six lines. "I was Sienese," she said. Oh, okay, there's her hometown. He said, "Make yourself known by your hometown and your name." She did. "I was Sienese, yo fui Sanese." It's a very flat sentence. We'll talk about more about this in a minute. And with these others, I now mend my wicked life. Just stop. I don't want to spend much time on this, but just to tell you, this is a Petrocchi problem. Petrocchi prefers in his text, the text I use, and most people use, the verb remendo, to mend. Many people think this really probably should be remondo, to cleanse now, to cleanse my wicked life. Both work, by the way. Remember, we had all that water imagery in the previous passage, so cleansing does work. Mending works, too, because of eyes sewn shut. Some people want to push this and say it's remendo, to mend, because it's women's work, mending, sewing, and she's a woman. I'm not sure. I don't see much of that in Dante at all. But again, I'm just following Petrocchi's text, even though I have my doubts about it. With these others, I now mend my wicked life, weeping to the one who can grant himself to us. I wasn't wise, although I was called Sapia. Now, I want to stop. There's her name. So she's given her hometown, and she's given her name, which is exactly what he asked for. Let me say one thing about her name. Most people pronounce her name Sapia, but if you look at the text, her name is probably Sapia. This is a little bit difficult, but if I just read you the line that it comes from, this line, I wasn't wise, although I was called Sapia or Sapia. It's in the Florentine, Savia non fui. I was not smart. I wasn't wise. Avenia che Sapia. Right there, Avenia che Sapia or Sapia, we have to question how that word would be pronounced. Now, most people, as I told you, pronounce the word Sapia, but there is an accent over the I. Sapia. And if you think of the opening line of comedy, you can feel it. Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita. There's the emphasis. Nostra vita. You can feel it fall on the V, right? In the same way here. Sapia. Vita. It may be that's the tradition. It is the traditional stress point in the line for Dante. And so it may be her name is Sapia. Sapia, not Sapia. I'm going to pronounce it the way most English speakers pronounce it, knowing that I may well be wrong. And let me jump away from this for a second and just say, the same thing goes with the name of this work. Most people say Commedia. Dante's Commedia, his comedy, Commedia, right? You probably heard this a million times, Commedia. But there is an accent over the I. And in fact, the way the word comedy lies twice in the poem, it is justified to say Commedia, because of the accent and the way it's accented in the line. In fact, when I was taught Dante by a Dante scholar, I was taught it as Commedia. And every time I say Commedia to people, I say, oh, I got a podcast about Commedia. They always have to stop me and say Commedia. And I'm like, well, maybe. It depends on how you pronounce the medieval word. Which nobody really knows how to do, but it depends on how you do that. Same here. Sapia, Sapia. Okay, so anyway, she's done exactly what he's told her to do. She's told him his hometown, and she's told him his name. But here's what's so fascinating. Dante was so effusive in his flattery, right? Yeah, that long flattery, that setup of, oh my gosh, somebody talked to me, and grace and charity and all that stuff. Given all of that, she's actually quite reticent. She answers with just the facts. She says, I was Sienese, and it's in the past tense. She's still schooling him. He says, what's your hometown? And she puts it in the past tense as if it doesn't matter anymore. I was as a past fact. I was Sienese, and I was called Sapia. But otherwise, she's giving the least amount of information possible. She's really holding back, with one exception, which we'll talk about in a minute. But I think that's really important to see her, because reticence is going to become part of what happens in the rest of Canto 13 and in Canto 14. A holding back, a withholding. And I think that reticence is connected to envy in the same way that alienation is, and in the same way the social contract is. There's a way in which envy causes me to pull back and be reticent. And as an envious soul, even though she's purgating it, she's still giving just the basic facts. Yet, this is a canto of explanations. Even her reticence is found inside a canto full of explanations. This is the Canto 13, where Virgil explains the methodology of the terraces of purgatory with the whip and the bridle. And she's about to come into a huge definition of envy. So while she may be giving him just exactly what he wants and only the basic information for the pilgrim, at the same time, we know that the texture of irony here is nice and thick because we are in a canto full of explanations, of generosity, of how things should go. And part of that irony is expressed in her verbal play. I mean, this is a very quick-witted soul. She plays off wise in the text, Savia, to then play off her own name. You know, I should have been smart because my name is essentially wisdom, but I wasn't so smart. More textural play, but also more in her. Although she's just giving the facts, we do get the idea she's verbally dexterous, and indeed she will prove to be so. She's about to give us a definition of envy, which will help us understand exactly what's going on here. So let's get to it. Last two lines, line 110 and 111. I felt joy at the bad fortune of others more so than I did at my own good fortune. Now, you should just know that she didn't say anything about herself. She just defined envy, and in a very particular way. Envy is a particular form of darkness, and a form of darkness we have forgotten. We have retranslated envy as jealousy. It's not that for Dante. Let's look at what she says. I felt joy at the bad fortune of others more so than I did at my own good fortune. She's not just talking about Schadenfreude. She's not just saying, oh, I'm happy when I saw, I don't know, some old guy trip down the stairs. I laughed out loud. It's part of what's expressed here. What it's saying is that she found herself happy at the misery of others and didn't find herself happy at her own good fortune. This is a modern problem. We have muted it by translating envy into jealousy. We ought not to, because this is a life-destroying, even world-destroying problem. To wish misery on others and to take great pleasure in their misery. Okay, let's say you have a really well-to-do friend. They're a tech bro and they've made a fortune in tech. They got the Lamborghini and they got 3 Teslas and they got the gold-plated mansion. I don't know. They got all the tech things. And you're living in, you know, your apartment and they're your friend, but you're kind of envious of them. And then let's say they get a horrible disease diagnosis. What if there's a little part of you that thinks, you deserve that? What if there's a little part of you that takes pleasure in their diagnosis? I know that sounds horrible, and yet at the same time, you know that that is incredibly human. To want other people to be miserable or to think they got their comeuppance, and I don't need any comeuppance. It's so soul-eating that this figure, Sapia, ahead of us, will utter some of the most blasphemous words in all of comedy because it can eat your soul inside out until there's nothing left. And so reticence isn't part of a social politeness. It's because there's not anything there. It's because you've been hollowed out by this desire for the misery of others. I find this so, what do I say, intrinsic to the political landscape across the United States, Canada, Europe, even Japan, Israel, the Middle East. I find this so endemic to the political landscape to revel in the malfortunes of others. And it's not because you necessarily even want their comeuppance. It's that in the end, and this figure, Sapia, will ultimately show us, she herself is miserable. And what she wants, above all else, is for everyone else to be as miserable or even more miserable than she is. That's the root of it. If you dig down into the furthest reaches of that hollowed interiority, you discover that envy has left you in a place where you're so miserable that you just wish everyone was more miserable than you are. That is horrific, and it is incredibly human. One more time, this passage, Purgatorio, Canto 13, lines 94 through 111. Oh, my brother, each of us is a citizen of the one true city, but you wanted to ask which of us lived in Italy as a pilgrim. I seemed to hear this reply as if from a spot a bit ahead of where I'd come to a stop, so I made myself felt by them as I moved ahead. Among the others, I saw a shade who looked to be waiting for something, much as the blind do. It was already raising its chin to hear as if someone were about to say, "What's up?" I said, "Spirit, you who domesticate yourself in order to go higher up, if you're the one who made that response to me, make yourself known by your hometown and your name." "I was Sienese," she said, "and with these others I now mend my wicked life, weeping to the one who can grant himself to us. I wasn't wise, although I was called Sapia. I felt joy at the bad fortune of others, more so than I did at my own good fortune." Thanks for listening to this episode of Walking with Dante. I'm glad you're on this walk with me. It is an overwhelming journey up Purgatorio, and I hope you see that it is an overwhelming human journey. I love Purgatorio, and I love it because I actually think it's the most human of the three canticles. It doesn't deal with spiritual essences and idealism the way Paradiso does, and it doesn't deal with the muck, the scum, the crud that Inferno does. Instead, this seems to be the textured, ironic, and multi-layered life I live, as expressed in Purgatorio. I'm glad we're on this walk together. Thanks for being with me. Rate this podcast, subscribe to it. I can't wait to come back. We gotta get more to Sapia, or Sapia. And otherwise, I know how to say my name. It's Mark Scarborough. And I will see you soon.